It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. In the center of our service, in the center of our lives, let us make room for life's quieter sides. We may use these first moments for lighting candles of memory and hope, or just sitting quietly, remembering who you are and why you are here.
Please join me in the spirit of prayer.
Let us remember that the answer is always to become grounded in a love of life more abundant. There is a courage which comes from that love of a transcendent and commanding sense of life. That courage can let us stand up when most around us are still scared into kneeling. Let us have faith that our solitary act of standing up will give others the courage to consider standing up in their own lives. There is a healthy kind of humility that can come from kneeling before authentic altars to worthy gods. Let us pray that the gods we serve with our lives are worthy of our service, and let us have the humility to serve them with all that we have, for such service can bless and empower us. But let us not forget what we already have, for it is also life-giving. We already have the ability to walk upright and never to kneel before moral and ethical ideals that are beneath us. We already have the strength and the courage to do this when we know that we must. This strength and this courage also bless and empower us, and they are closer at hand. Let us never be seduced into becoming so frightened that we forget to stand up for all we know to be life-affirming. For that is the spark of God that is an essential part of almost all of us. And we must nurture that spark and must use it to ignite our spirits, or it may go out. And that we cannot afford. And so let us kneel when kneeling is appropriate, but on those other more numerous occasions when we should stand up for ourselves, for others, and for what truly gives us life, let us stand and receive those special blessings that come only to the courageous. Amen. This is the fifth and final in the series of sermons adapted from Naomi Klein's book, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism, which, as I've said before, I think is the most important book I've read in the last 25 years for understanding the master narrative, the plot behind so much that has been going on in our world since at least 1973. Today I want to share Klein's insights about 9/11 and our illegal invasion and occupation of Iraq, and then some very real world and very optimistic signs from another author to end both the sermon and the children's story, which, like all good children's stories, isn't really just for children. Naomi Klein's focus is on some of the economic backstory of 9/11 and Iraq in Israel and the United States. It starts with the dot-com crash of 2000, which threatened all the stock markets in the world, but which threatened Israel most of all, because they had the most high-tech dependent economy on Earth. The country went into immediate freefall, and by June of 2001, analysts were predicting that roughly 300 high-tech Israeli firms would go bankrupt with tens of thousands of layoffs. A Tel Aviv business newspaper declared in a headline in the summer of 2001 that 2002 would be the worst year for Israeli economy since 1953. So there was genuine panic. Then in the summer of 2001, the government encouraged the tech industry to branch out into security and surveillance. A slew of new startups were launched, specializing in everything from search and nail data mining to surveillance cameras to terrorist profiling. When the market for these services and devices exploded after 9/11, the Israeli state rejoiced that the growth provided by the dot-com bubble would be replaced with a homeland security boom. Ideologically, it was the perfect marriage of the Likud Party's hawkishness and its commitment to Chicago School economics. By 2003, Israel was already making a stunning recovery, and by 2004, the country had seemed to pull off a miracle. It was performing better than almost any Western economy. Much of this growth was due to Israel's savvy positioning of itself as a kind of shopping mall for homeland security technologies. The timing was perfect. Overnight, Israel became, in the words of Forbes magazine, the go-to country for anti-terrorism technologies. The business of providing security in Israel and around the world is directly responsible for much of Israel's meteoric growth in recent years. The war on terror industry saved Israel's faltering economy, much as the disaster capitalism complex that I talked about last week helped rescue the global stock markets. But since this is another application of the Chicago School plan, you already know the plot. So you won't be surprised to learn that Israel's post-9/11 growth spurt has produced a rapid division of their society between rich and poor. In 2007, over 24% of Israelis were living below the poverty line, with more than 35% of all of their children in poverty. This is compared with 8% of children 20 years earlier. This discarding of 25 to 60% of the population has been the hallmark of the Chicago School Crusade since the misery villages began mushrooming throughout the southern cone of Latin America in the 70s. In South Africa, Russia, and New Orleans, the rich build walls around themselves. Israel has taken this disposal process a step further. It has built walls around the desperate and dangerous poor. There have been many articles on the deep overlap between our own neoconservative group and a group of men with dual citizenship in the U.S. and Israel. I've read lists of the names of up to 16 men with dual citizenship among the biggest players in Washington. These have included Rabbi Dov Zakheim, who was comptroller of our Defense Department when it came up missing $2.3 million. It includes Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Perle, Michael Chertoff, the head of our Homeland Security, George Tenet, former head of our FBI, Elliot Abrams, who played a key role in the Iran-Contra scandal under President Reagan as Assistant Secretary of State, and has served George W. Bush as Deputy Assistant to the President and Deputy National Security Advisor. The list also includes Donald Kagan, one of the chief architects of the project for the New American Century, as well as Mark Grossman, Douglas Fife, and a half a dozen others whose names aren't as well known. Most of these men were contributors to that project for the New American Century, which was published in September of 2000, and which contained the blueprint for our American imperialism that has come to life since 9/11. Even the strongest critics from the left, however, tend to see the neoconservatives as true believers, motivated exclusively by a commitment to the supremacy of American and Israeli power that is so all-consuming they are prepared to sacrifice economic interests in favor of security. But this distinction, as Naomi Klein puts it, is both artificial and amnesiac. The right to limitless profit-seeking, she says, has always been at the center of neoconservative ideology. With the war on terror, the neocons didn't abandon their corporatist economic goals. They found a new, much more effective way to achieve them. Of course, our Washington hawks, both our U.S. citizens and our dual country, U.S. and Israeli citizens, of course they are committed to an imperial role for the United States in the world and for Israel in the Middle East. Both in Israel and the U.S., we now have a state of endless war abroad and a security state at home. But this sounds familiar. This matches perfectly with the methods of the disaster capitalism complex I talked about last week, which has built a multi-billion dollar industry based precisely on the picture of war outside and a security state within, often secured by private contractors rather than government forces. In a speech on September 10th, 2001, Donald Rumsfeld announced that the Pentagon could not account for that $2.3 trillion I mentioned earlier. He also announced his intention to outsource many defense jobs to private industry. By the next day, nobody remembered much about either of these points. But that idea, at the heart of Rumsfeld's forgotten speech, is the central tenet of the Bush regime. Following Milton Friedman's economic ideas that the job of government is not to govern, but to subcontract the task to the private sector, which will do it for a profit. Let me translate that. What this means is transferring our tax dollars away from governmental agencies, which are accountable to us, and into private contractors, which have no accountability to us. Over 90% of Blackwater's money, for example, comes from state and government contracts, which means our tax dollars, your tax dollars. But in Iraq, Blackwater employees cannot be prosecuted for crimes they commit, including murder, under either Iraqi laws or under U.S. laws, as we learned when they killed 17 Iraqi civilians last September. And you all remember that story. It's surprising when you get out into the weird wings of this how many roads lead back to Milton Friedman. For Donald Rumsfeld, this idea of selling off the job of providing security to private contractors like Blackwater, this wasn't something he came up with on his own. This dates back 40 years to the early 1960s. Now you'll see this coming. When he attended seminars at, you guessed it, the University of Chicago Economics Department and developed a particularly close connection with Milton Friedman. What happened in our country in the period of mass disorientation after 9/11 was, in retrospect, a domestic form of economic shock therapy. The Chicago school plan finally inflicted forcefully on our own country. That Bush team, Friedmanite to the core, quickly moved to exploit the shock that gripped the nation to push through its radical vision of a hollow government in which everything from warfighting to disaster response was a for-profit venture. This is how it was done in every other country. A crisis that paralyzes the nation is used to provide cover for the very fast looting of the government and disempowerment of the middle class. The Bush team created a whole new rationale for its actions, the war on terror, built from the start to loot our government and systematically remove the social supports from underneath the middle and lower classes. So far, the only big thing they have not been able to accomplish, though they're still trying, is to completely loot the Social Security funds. For decades, the Friedmanite market had been feeding off the appendages of the state. Now it could devour the core. The mantra, "September 11th changed everything," neatly disguised the fact that for Milton Friedman disciples and the corporations whose interests they serve, the only thing that changed was the ease with which they could pursue their ambitious economic agenda. Now, there have been some amazing statements made to justify this looting. Between us, we can probably come up with 500 of them. But to take only one of them, this is one of these things where you think, you can't make this stuff up. Ken Minahan, former director of the National Security Agency, said, "Homeland Security is too important to be left to the government." Think about this. The security of our country is too important to be left to the government. The rules have been changed right under our noses, under the cover of the distraction and the manufactured war on terrorism following 9/11. But this is just how it was done in dozens of other countries. There's much more to 9/11 and its effects and implications, but now I need to move on to Iraq. It's been well established that the Bush administration wanted to invade Iraq when they came into office, and that they had discussed it in January of 2001. The invasion of Iraq to control its oil, as well as the removal of Saddam Hussein, was called for in that Project for the New American Century, published by our neocons in September of 2000. Iraq was, as Paul Wolfowitz said, where the oil was. And it was also an enemy of Israel. But other reasons for invading Iraq were tactical and economic, and most of us have not been made as aware of them. John Perkins wrote about it in his best-selling book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, a few years ago, where he says, "Iraq was very important to us, much more than was obvious. Contrary to common public opinion, Iraq is not simply about oil. It is also about water and geopolitics. Both the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers flow through Iraq. Thus, of all the countries in that part of the world, Iraq controls the most important sources of increasingly critical water resources. Also, Iraq is in a very strategic location. It borders on Iran, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Syria, and Turkey, and it has a coastline on the Persian Gulf. It is within easy missile-striking distance of both Israel and the former Soviet Union. Military strategists equate modern Iraq to the Hudson River Valley during the French and Indian War and the American Revolution. In the 18th century, the French, the British, and the Americans knew that whoever controlled the Hudson River Valley controlled the continent. Today, it is common knowledge that whoever controls Iraq holds the key to controlling the Middle East. That's John Perkins. Another author says, very succinctly, controlling Iraq is about oil as power rather than oil as fuel. Control over the Persian Gulf translates into control over Europe, Japan, and China. It's having our hand on the spigot. Invading and occupying Iraq also offered the chance to drive a wedge into the Arab and Muslim worlds, which would help Israel, but would also serve our own imperialist needs. And we're planning to stay there. Remember that we have built the world's largest embassy there, a building that could employ 5,000 people. And it also fits the Friedmanite vision. There are so many reasons in answer to the question, why Iraq? After the Chicago School had conquered, that means looted, Latin America, Africa, Eastern Europe, and Asia, the Arab world, and of course the United States, called out as the final frontiers. And we handled Iraq as we had handled the other countries, rewriting its laws to allow wholesale looting of the country almost immediately. When Paul Bremer was sent to Iraq to act like the de facto government of the country, all the careful efforts during the 1990s to present free trade as something other than an imperial project, all those efforts were abandoned. Bremer lived in Saddam's turquoise-domed Republican palace. He received trade and investment laws by email from the Department of Defense. He printed them out, signed them, and imposed them by fiat on the shocked, awed, invaded, and occupied Iraqi people. This is the same Chicago School plan. So now you know what's going to come next. You've probably observed, as I have, that once you understand the plot, it gets disturbingly easy to see it worked out in country after country. Bremer changed the laws immediately to invite the corporate looting. One law lowered Iraq's corporate tax rate from roughly 45% to a flat 15%, straight out of Milton Friedman's playbook. Another allowed foreign companies to own 100% of Iraqi assets. Now, this was to prevent a repeat of Russia, where the big money from looting the government went to the local rulers and their families. You see, they're improving this plan a little bit each time. Even better, investors could take 100% of the profits they made in Iraq out of the country. They would not be required to reinvest, and they would not be taxed. Investors could sign leases and contracts that would last for 40 years and then be eligible for renewal, which meant that future elected governments would be saddled with deals signed by their occupiers. It's a neat trick. Bremer reworked Iraq's trademark and copyright laws. He eliminated trade barriers and afforded foreign businesses the option of circumventing Iraq's legal system entirely and taking any disputes to international tribunals. Previously, Iraq banks were closed to foreign ownership. Now, not only can foreign banks operate in Iraq, they can take over private Iraqi banks as well. He refused to turn power over to the Iraqis. You remember all the hubbub about holding elections as soon as possible when Bremer got there. But it became immediately clear that the Iraqis would never give up their oil fields. So Bremer canceled all elections and cut down democracy whenever it reared its unwelcome head. You remember the stunning quote from Boris Yeltsin's assistant in Russia that, quote, "In order to have a democracy in society, there must be a dictatorship in power." It's an amazing quote. It's in code, of course. The phrase democracy in society meant the freedom to loot the society, not the freedom of the people to stop the looting. That's what the dictatorship in power was needed to prevent. But that structure has been true in every country in which the Chicago School Plan has been put into effect. In order for the corporations to freely loot the government assets, including the money formerly spent on social services to support the middle and lower classes, there must be a dictatorship of power, because otherwise the citizens wouldn't allow it. Someone must find a way to put the citizens on their knees. This means that it's fair to wonder whether there will also have to be a dictatorship of power in our own country. The most important negotiations going on in Iraq today are still to try and transfer control of their oil primarily to American investors and corporations for the next generation or two. The Iraqi parliament has so far refused to approve any of this, even though there are reports that members of their parliament have been offered bribes of $5 million each if they'll just sell out their country in favor of U.S. control of their oil. Now, I wonder, how many of our own elected officials in Washington do you think could resist a $5 million bribe? It's sobering. I saw figures this week saying that our illegal invasion and occupation of Iraq has cost us nearly 4,500 deaths among our military and almost 75,000 casualties. And this is not counting more than 1 million Iraqis we have killed. But these numbers aren't significant if you're only looking at the opportunity for profit, oil, and controlling the Middle East. First, we choose the gods we will serve. They, in turn, determine what we are capable of seeing and caring about. There are many more descriptions and predictions in Naomi Klein's book, but I'll post them in the much longer version of this sermon that I'll put online with all the other information I've had to leave out to save time, because I know that as interested as you are, you also have lives. I want to move toward some of the very real and very optimistic signs that are going on all over the world, including right here in Austin. The kind of hope that is flowering is like the widespread grassroots movements going on in Latin America that I talked about a few weeks ago, but on a much, much larger scale. A church member sent me a wonderful essay by Paul Hawken that I hadn't seen, which describes a lot of this, and I want to use it. The essay is taken from his new book, Blessed Unrest, but he's been writing books on ecology and commerce for 20 years. He says he's given nearly 1,000 talks about the environment in the past 15 years, and that he's noticed something he believes is unprecedented in human history. The existence of what he now believes are between 1 and 2 million organizations working toward ecological sustainability and various forms of social justice all over the world. This is a kind of burgeoning awareness, growing and spreading in every city and country, made up of families in India, students in Australia, farmers in France, the landless in Brazil, the poor of Honduras and Durban, villagers in remote places, indigenous tribes of Bolivia, and housewives in Japan. Its leaders are farmers, zoologists, shoemakers, and poets. Our media don't make us aware of the huge movement bubbling up. When the African woman, Wangari Maathai, won the Nobel Peace Prize a few years ago, the wire service stories didn't mention the network of 6,000 different women's groups in Africa planting trees. Wangari Maathai, and one of our members in the church is a personal friend of hers since 1977, deserved the Peace Prize and deserved the attention for the singular work she did. But far more empowering, perhaps, is the fact that there are now 6,000 such groups in Africa planting trees. Second, when we hear about a chemical spill in a river, how often have you heard it mentioned that there are more than 4,000 organizations in North America who have adopted a river, a creek, or a stream in order to clean it up and save it? Those are stories that offer entries for us. Paul Hawkins says this is the first time in history that a large social movement is not bound together by a charismatic leader. It isn't an ism. What binds it together are ideas, not ideologies. And what this nameless movement is doing is to offer solutions to what appear to be insoluble dilemmas. Poverty, global climate change, terrorism, ecological degradation, polarization of income, and loss of culture. And what drives it is tens or hundreds of millions of people getting back in touch in spite of their governments, getting back in touch with what it means to be fully human, fully alive, and fully involved. Theologically, it is people getting back to serving a God worth serving, a God of life, love, justice, and courage. It is like children beginning to stand up in that valley and to notice and connect with the others who are also standing up. I hope and believe that this dispersed movement will prevail, will suffuse and permeate most institutions. I think it may change enough people to begin the reversal of many, many years of frenzied self-destruction. This is kind of like the story of the 100th monkey of a generation ago. The kind of healing, the kind of revolution we need, according to Naomi Klein, Paul Hawken, John Perkins, and millions of others involved in these movements, it will not come from our governments. It will not come from electing a Democratic president. It's unrealistic to expect our mass media to educate us simply because this kind of education does not draw crowds. It isn't sensational. But our mass media are struggling for their existence, and they need to draw crowds in order to attract advertisers. This kind of opportunity exists in Austin with dozens of these movements and organizations right here in town. If we are to have a safe and fair new world, it will come, as it came in the children's story, from individuals beginning to stand up to the moral midgets who have run roughshod over our world for a very long time. It will come from individuals standing up to them here, there, and everywhere. Like the Iraqi parliament members who are refusing to be bribed even for $5 million because they serve a higher and a holier cause. To stand up is to refuse to be terrorized by governments who learned long ago that keeping us frightened is the best way to make us give up our freedoms. Healing ourselves and our world is not a liberal or a conservative activity. It is a sacred activity, and it is absolutely within our reach. It is time to stand up.